Now we continue with the second presentation from episode 87, which Lynn introduces. I'm going to follow the earlier formula, supplementing it by other Unwelcome Guests episodes. I've listened to it countless times, and I keep finding new depths to it. So I'm very impressed. This was written 17 years ago, and yet speaks to me very powerfully of the world in 2019.
McMurtry is the author of numerous books and one of Canada's foremost social critics and public intellectuals. He spoke last month at a forum in Toronto on how Canada should respond to war and terrorism, which was sponsored by the organization Science for Peace. In spite of the forum's nominal topic, McMurtry's presentation shone a spotlight over terrain similar to that covered by the Richard Moore article with which we began the program. John McMurtry.
I think we're at a turning point of history really right now. One could have said that now for 5 years. The reason I've been so prodigious, I feel completely driven by world events because I do feel we're at a very fateful moment in the history of the human race. So I'll go right to it now. I've been asked to speak on the topic, why is there a war in Afghanistan? And I could focus on the innumerable suspicious circumstances of this latest U.S. aerial war on a poverty-stricken country, its typical overriding of international law, its strategic fit with U.S. corporate designs for foreign oil resources, and the U.S. past strategic support of the very enemy said to be targeted, like Noriega, like Saddam, and like Milosevic in the past. But instead, I'm going to situate this latest U.S.-led war on a third world region within a much wider global process. I'm going to consider America's new war as the latest expression of a much deeper and wider terrorist campaign of an emergent totalitarian pattern of instituting world corporate rule with no limit of occupation or accountability beyond itself. Unhappily, it is not easy to see Canada's foreign policy role in all of this as anything other than obedient subjugation to this transnational corporate agenda at every senior level of decision-making. And I'm thinking of the trade negotiators at DFAT and all the way up to the minister when I say that. The unseen terrorist pattern. The gravest problem with corporate market fundamentalism is that it is decoupled from society's life conditions. Its entire model is. It is, in fact, incapable of recognizing any value to anything except corporate value adding, which it is assumed should regulate all peoples and all conditions of life on Earth for, quote, efficiency and maximum growth. To this point, there has been no outside margin, and this is the totalitarian nature of this project or program, there's been no outside margin to this total doctrine's demands or government subservience to them. Since the commitments of a society to safeguard the lives of its members and to ensure that they're able to express themselves as human is the measure of its civilization, this global corporate program is not merely uncivilized, it is beneath recognition terrorist in its meaning. For if we recognize the real meaning of terrorism, and I don't mean the meaning of terrorism that we've had with Bill C-35 and C-36, which effectively say, you know, as in I think Section 27, intended to cause serious interference with an essential facility or system, I think we see the disconnection of the very meanings of words from their actual natural meaning. Terrorism without terror. They're talking systems, not people's terror. Now, I'm going to define terrorism with some fidelity to the actual meaning of terrorism, unlike our government laws, which are part of this global program. And I would say that the real meaning of terrorism is to instill in innocent people fear for their life security, to coerce their compliance to an armed faction's demands. And I think we see this pattern increasingly at work across World Life Organization. Under the financial dictates of the corporate market, backed by rising extremes of armed force, citizens everywhere are subjected to a low-intensity campaign of destabilization and fear that leaves no aspect of their lives secure. Now, I have a lot of documentation of this, but I won't be able to get into that today. But I think this is true even in Canada, one of the world's most well-off societies, the silent terror grows. Its vast water heritage is so in peril that people unprecedentedly die from its pollution.
487.
In order to access the gas contained in shale thousands of feet below, the drillers must use a process patented by Halliburton called fracking that requires the injection of billions of gallons of a toxic brew of water, sand, and chemicals into the earth to force gas from the shale formations. This practice has already despoiled the Intermountain West and is rapidly ruining the land, water, and lives of people just to the south of me in rural Pennsylvania. The only reason they could use this toxic process was that the Bush-Cheney administration and their pals in Congress put a provision in the 2005 Energy Act exempting these drilling corporations from the Clean Air and Water Act provisions. The reason for doing so should have been obvious, but is now, sadly for those places, all too obvious. These processes poison the air and poison the water. They take clean, fresh water and ruin it. So-called development has been progressively turning Earth into a desert through its wasteful conduct. Did you know that the Sahara Desert was once a forest? The Romans cut it down to take the wood, so all the topsoil blew away. Iraq was once a fertile crescent, not a blazing desert. Have you ever wondered why the Bible talks of cedars of Lebanon? Yes, there used to be cedars, not desert there. Greece used to have woods and springs. The history of civilization could be described as the history of humans turning earth to desert. The gas drillers are salivating at the prospect of taking all our water and fouling it for use in their profit-making activities, then dumping the polluted mess in the woods when nobody's looking, as they have already done elsewhere. What do they care? They'll trash my home the way they've trashed other people's homes. They trash places and are allowed to do so because corrupt or lazy governments allow them in the name of the sacred economy. Fact. If they had to perform their activities without ruining the land, in economic terms without externalizing the damage for us to bear, their activities would no longer be profitable. You've heard them whining about that, right? So we, and others before us, are to be destroyed so they can make money. That sounds absurd, but that's pretty much the way things have been done in America. Things will go on that way until we put our feet down.
While our government signs its future away to U.S. engineered trade and investment dictates. The minds of our young are so shackled by a culture of violence and demands to buy that their capacity to think is stunted, while their public education is increasingly structured as a marketing site to reproduce students as compliant servo mechanisms.
Now, we've had quite a lot of material about schools on the show, including the audiobook from Ivan Illich, Deschooling Society. Illich referred to forced schooling as the reproductive organ of the consumer society. The following speaker, John Taylor Gatto, was a very celebrated American teacher and, to my eyes, exposed the fraud that is mass compulsion schooling like no one else. His magnum opus on the history of forced schooling, the underground history of American education, we also produced as an audiobook, and it's available for download from unwelcomeguest.net/audiobooks. I consider him to have been the greatest single whistleblower of the true purposes of mass compulsion schooling. So let's hear two sections from him, speaking about documents published in 1906. First, from episode 562.
The very first commissioner of American schooling, national commissioner of schooling, a fellow named William Torrey Harris, wrote in 1906 that the point of institutional schooling was to turn people against themselves. So he was really quite advanced. The idea of dividing and conquer usually means several parties involved, but to be divided against yourself, self-alienation is the expression he used. That was the point of it. He said, this purpose is best achieved in dark, airless corridors. In other words, in dismal places. And anyone who's passed through the usual public schooling place knows what he's talking about. Now, he was very open about this whole enterprise being to the advantage of management.
And from episode 539.
If you want to know the motives of this project, you need only read the first public mission statement of Rockefeller's General Education Board that was printed in its first report to well-wishers, issued in 1906. In our dreams, people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. The present education conventions of intellectual and character education fade from their minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own will upon a grateful and responsive folk. Can you believe people actually wrote this and printed it? We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or men of science. We have not to raise up from them authors, educators, poets, men of letters. We shall not search for artists, painters, musicians, lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of which we have an ample supply. The task is simple. We will organize children and teach them in a perfect way the things their fathers and mothers are doing in an imperfect way. The real purpose of modern schooling was announced by Edward Ross of the University of Wisconsin in the same year that was written. Ross is generally considered one of the three founders of the 20th century discipline called sociology. And in a book bluntly called Social Control, Ross wrote, I'll quote directly, "Plans are underway to replace family, church, and community with propaganda, education, and mass media."
While their public education is increasingly structured as a marketing site to reproduce students as compliant servile mechanisms, all part of the coming GATT, too, or GATS. The rule of law is cumulatively overridden by transnational trade edicts to subjugate all that exists for corporate profit. Try to find a limit. There isn't one. Riot squads club and gas unarmed opponents, and civil liberties are stripped by Orwellian security machinations. Always the threat is against life and life means. That's the design of it, and I don't think it's preconscious. Always the threat is against life and life means to coerce compliance to corporate demands. Our country's national symbol for the hemisphere, health care for all, is degraded and privatized for profit as citizens are deprived of family positions by the hundreds of thousands. 30,000 in my own city of Guelph are without family physicians. Corporate motor commodities and schemes now so lay waste to Canada's land and water and public ways that it may be unsafe to breathe the air, walk freely, or count on a forest or aquatic habitat being there in a year. The vocation of serving fellow human and planetary life by one's daily service of work, our humanity itself, is slashed in every life function. Always the command is to turn money into more money for corporate investors or do not survive. Well, I think this is real terror. In fact, I would say it's the very threat to economic and financial security that the government legislation itself recognizes as terror is upon us. But as a structure, the U.S.-led structure here, you operate by projection. You project onto those who oppose you what you're doing yourself. It's a secret to their ideology and indeed their law of motion. The shape of this beast's ever grosser lines dwarfs the monster beheld by St. John of the Apocalypse or the boundless greed of Duryodhana of the tale told by the Mahabharata. We live, in fact, under an increasingly global reign of terror, but our disconnection from the meaning is its triumph.
Help me out one time. Help me out before I lose my mind.
Instead, we're made to believe that the terror comes from pre-industrial fanatics in poor countries.
Rebel leaders in hiding. You understand, in the caves, in the secret underground lair. Does that sound like anything familiar to you? Does that sound like the script from a James Bond movie? I think so too. Osama bin Laden in his secret underground lair, sending the troops, they really don't care. But no one is supposed to die. No one is supposed to fry. That is the one big lie.
The world has been usurped by a pattern familiar in the microcosm, but not yet decoded at the macro level, a revolt against human society itself. The historical maturation of nations after the world's greatest depression and war was called the Great Transformation by Karl Polanyi, but the Great Reversal has not yet been publicly deciphered. Its meaning is primeval. It is the atavistic return of society to an unaccountable male gang seeking to dominate the world.
486.
Sadism seemed to me to be the salient feature of the Bush-Cheney political culture that we experienced for the past 8 years. From the kinky torture to Cheney's so-called hunting, which is not hunting. Many of you live in rural areas where hunting is common, so you know what hunting is. Hunting is not what Cheney and his friends do. They do killing. They go to these so-called ranches where caged animals are released right in front of them so they can shoot at them. It's the shooting without the hunting. On one of these trips, Cheney shot 400 pheasants. 400 pheasants. They want to portray themselves as macho men, but they are cowards who shoot fish in a barrel, so to speak.
We see this pattern in the 9/11 war. Its public phase began with thousands of people of mixed nationalities, most American civilians, were killed by suicide bombers of a foreign male gang of Islamic fundamentalists. The numbers, by the way, interestingly changing from 6,900 to 3,900 to 2,772, just part of this whole operation and with very little publicity. Each side then duly proclaimed the other the embodiment of evil, same story. Each repudiated the law from start to finish, same story. And both killed as many innocent people as got in the way of their war to rule other countries, same story. While the gang leaders throughout stayed unscathed behind walls of armed protectors, both called each other cowardly murderers. There is little difference in moral substance between these atavistic gangs, although a megalomaniac rhetoric of each proclaims direct backing from God.
Born-again Christian George W. Bush himself said he was on a mission from God when he launched the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, invoking religion many times before enacting murderous policies. Not to mention Eric Prince, former Blackwater CEO of the mercenary force enlisted to carry out America's dirty work, who views himself as a Christian crusader, tasked with eliminating Muslims from the earth. Interestingly, I don't remember the outcry about Christian fanaticism causing the deaths of over 1 million Iraqis. Aside from its pure insanity, this type of crusader language only exacerbates the jihadists' belief that they're indeed fighting a holy war with the West, thus justifying their martyrdom. Overall, this attack is not about Islam. It's not about childlike concepts of good and evil. It's about a system that breeds inequality and oppression, the outcomes of which are exploited, the causes complex. It's not a fight between Islam and the West. It's a fight between the most extreme and militarized ideologues on all sides.
There is little difference in moral substance between these atavistic gangs, although a megalomaniac rhetoric of each proclaims direct backing from God. Both sides are mass killers, and both systematically destroy civilians and their means of life with sanctimonious justification, overriding all accountability to truth or due legal process. Both proclaim their mission as the work of divine justice, overriding all accountability to truth or due legal process.
266.
Professor David Ray Griffin.
For the first time, we are on the verge of a truly global empire, an empire with no borders. Our own country is involved in what Richard Falk and others call the Global Domination Project. And yet, from watching the mainstream media, you would never guess that these catastrophic events were going on. Like the Roman citizens during the Roman Empire, we are entertained and distracted with bread and circuses. I'm a Christian theologian, so what I am particularly upset about is their claiming to do this empire and this destruction of the world in the name of God. As a theologian, I deal with the relation between the divine and the demonic. And if you look at the Abrahamic traditions, or you look at any of the major traditions in the world, there is a large agreement that that which we call holy, that which we call divine, is that which embodies truth, justice, compassion. So if there is such a thing as the demonic, it would be that which is diametrically opposed to that and has power to threaten its very purposes. And so the demonic would be that which embodies the big lie, that which embodies injustice based on greed, and that which is, instead of having love and compassion, has total indifference to the welfare of those that they're inflicting their dominance on. The major media now have chosen to be the mouthpiece and the camouflage for this system that can only be called demonic.
Both proclaim their mission as the work of divine justice, and both destroy the lives and human conditions of innocent others with a pathological abandon that takes the breath away. That is, in fact, their function. It is of demonstration, destructions, and killings, to command by terror and seize whatever is wanted, with complicit governments like Canada's and Britain's barking and crouching behind.
413.
Professor Marnia Lazreg, author of Torture and the Twilight of Empire, from Algiers to Baghdad.
We have laws on the books that prohibit torture, but it's carried out anyway. And if you look at the U.S. intelligence operating manual, it really lists all of the methods that are prohibited. But we know that they're being used both in Guantanamo Bay and in Iraq. And of course, we're not talking about Afghanistan. Afghanistan also. I mean, the torturers who were in Afghanistan found their way also in Abu Ghraib. At the end of an empire, torture appears as a very important method for keeping the power of the imperial nation in place. And the message that I'd like to convey is that torture was part and parcel of a military ideological structure. So it was not simply something incidental that happened on occasion because the French military grabbed someone whom they knew had some vital information. It was not that at all. It was used as the method of interrogation.
518.
The ACLU in 2005... had been pushing the U.S. military, the Pentagon, to release autopsy reports of civilians who died in Iraq during the first 2 years of the war. And they had to threaten court. I mean, they had the right under the Freedom of Information Act, but the Pentagon was really dragging their feet. Finally, they got copies of 44 autopsy reports. Now, these autopsy reports were the U.S. military doctors' examinations of the bodies after somebody died while in U.S. custody, civilians. So in October of 2005, they released a press release, and they said, well, of the 44 autopsy reports, 23 of those listed the cause of death as homicide. And these were multiple sites. And now, this wasn't just Abu Ghraib. I mean, this was multiple sites in Afghanistan and Iraq. The conditions of the body clearly indicated, and doctors had verified, that these people were tortured to death. extensive bruises, contusions, broken bones, strangulation, just really awful stuff. The rest of the bodies, the rest of the autopsy reports, the primary cause of death was heart failure while being tortured. And, you know, these were young people. So this was really, for the first time, absolute proof that we were torturing people to death on a wide scale, not just embarrassing them or having dogs snip at them and that, but really beating and killing people. And ACLU, with their press release, put this out, and AP picked it up. Associated Press, which reaches a billion people in the world, they put this out on their wire service to all 1,700 daily newspapers in the United States, to all 5,000 radio and television news programs across the country. And LexisNexis checks and further examination, we found out that 99.5% of them did not run the story. So LA Times had it on page A4. Seattle paper had it buried inside a larger story in Iraq, and the rest were small Midwest papers that actually covered it. So that meant that 1,600 plus newspaper editors saw that story and decided not to run it. And we don't know why, but they just decided that maybe they thought it would be seen as unpatriotic, or the American people wouldn't believe it, that we were torturing people to death. Whatever the reason, we know that this was a factual decision. So this wasn't just the high levels of MSNBC or Fox or that making a decision. This was right down inside of grassroots media in the U.S. today. And that really kind of set us back a bit. And we started to think about what that means and the degree to which an American empire will go to propagate and push and continue to push global capital power worldwide.
It was used as the method of interrogation. And this was part and parcel of a military doctrine and an ideology. One of the designers of this doctrine, Trinquier, called torture the antidote to terrorism, and he called it a war weapon. So, because what's happening today in the U.S. is that we're not quite sure of what's going on. It is the same thing is happening. Torture is part and parcel of what goes on in Iraq, in Guantanamo Bay, in Afghanistan. Actually, there is a historian at the University of Wisconsin, Alfred McCoy, you know, wrote a book called The Question of Torture, and it's a very serious book because it took him many years to show what's going on, the kinds of tortures that are being implemented in Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere are really a continuation of the experiments with torture which the CIA had engaged in between 1952 and 1962 in secret. The CIA was spending $1 billion a year between 1952 and 1962.
That is, in fact, their function. It is of demonstration, destructions, and killings to command by terror and seize whatever is wanted, with complicit governments like Canada's and Britain's barking and crouching behind. The real deal is struck beneath public notice. Incalculably more innocent people in terror in exchange for incalculably more oil supplies for U.S.-led corporations, and as a side deal, $200 billion in further giveaways of public revenues to corporations and the very rich in the U.S., another unseen aspect. But the primeval criminal gang structure is not tracked for two reasons. The first is that saturating conditioning disconnects people from reality. It is easy. Just tell the people someone is attacking them and then denounce anyone who protests as unpatriotic and a threat to the nation's security. These are Hermann Göring's words, and they transmit the code of this gang form of rule. Concealed under the most ludicrous lies, its coercion reigns supreme. Already university employees and indeed a talk show host have been unconstitutionally suspended in the U.S. for pointing out the most undeniable truths. The disorder goes to the heart of the ruling corporate psyche. Consider the pattern. Now moving into images of manliness and how the surrounding culture transmits this pattern.
507.
The sports culture has grown increasingly aggressive and violent, and we see that in the hockey fights and baseball fights. We'd be naive to think that the way grown men act, on the field or off, has no impact on how boys learn to think of themselves as men. But it's important to remember that what's being taught in a lot of modern sports is not just violence and aggression, but the even more powerful idea that being a real man is connected with being intimidating and controlling. Just look at what happens when a basketball player does an in-your-face dunk over his opponent and then rubs it in. The lesson about manhood is clear. You gain respect by disrespecting another person. Look at the phenomenal growth in popularity of pro wrestling. People can argue back and forth about whether it's sports or just pure theatrics, but one point that's hard to argue with is that what takes place both within the ring and outside of it is a celebration of dominance and the projection of power in a way that links being a man with being abusive and violent.
And it's telling The Undertaker that you better come get your man here. A great opportunity for The Undertaker to come down. Wait a minute.
So boys are being taught over and over again that real manhood is connected to size and strength and muscularity.
The adolescent group mind plots in secret, and I'm thinking of working right up to the war room. The adolescent group mind plots in secret behind the closed doors of secluded forts for control of the rest of society to maximize the gang's private take. I really think we're at an adolescent gang stage of history. Sex and violence are the ruling images of its kingdom of ever bigger deals and attacks on a designated outgroups. The gang's ethos of power and control pervades the larger society with a barbaric code of acquisitive stratagem, takeover of others' territories, continuous extraction of gang tribute, and indiscriminate violence and armed force at will. The gang's ethos of power and control pervades the larger society with a barbaric code of acquisitive stratagem, takeover of others' territories, continuous extraction of gang tribute, and indiscriminate violence and armed force at will. Throughout group slogans and tough talk to reinforce the bonds of male and servant female bravado in the face of ever greater extremes of life deprivation, confiscation, and fear. The universal insecurity the many feel is, as the resistance grows, played back to them as what the gang is protecting them from. The logic of rule by force is then openly declared to protect them from the terror. The U.S. president declares an ultimatum to the world. You are either with us or for the terrorists. And after starving Afghanistan is carpet bombed, his administration proclaims, who will be next? Charles Krauthammer, glorious name, declares the mood in Time magazine. Quote, America is no mere international citizen. It is a dominant power in the world, more dominant than any since Rome. Accordingly, America is in a position to reshape norms. How? By unapologetic and implacable demonstrations of will. This is as the bombs fall. The extortion racket of the neighborhood is, in a word, writ large as the international war against terrorism, a war in which those who monopolize terror are licensed to exempt themselves from its meaning.
705.
It's extremely Orwellian. I mean, I've never seen anything quite so peculiar as an anti-terror march where you've got the biggest terrorists on the planet leading it.
706.
The definition of terrorism I found a dozen or so years ago, looked up, and it occurred quite specifically, it's acts of violence to pursue ideological political ends when they're committed by non-state actors. Neatly avoiding the discussion about state terrorism, because according to that definition, it doesn't exist. I looked that up, by the way, when some Muslims in the East End of London had been arrested and charged with trying to make bombs. They hadn't actually made or let off any bombs. Nevertheless, the BBC chose to intersperse that footage with a video of some bombs going off in Madrid. So we had real people suffering real bomb attacks shown on the television as part of a report about some people being taken into custody, being charged with making bombs. Now that prompted me to see, what is the BBC actually doing here? Could that in itself be called an act of terrorism? And no, because it's by the state apparatus, that could perhaps be called terrorization, but terrorism was excluded. So this week the focus on the use of terror to keep people afraid, not by independent organizations or even false flag covertly funded opposition groups, but by paid up nation states. So the US, as I see it, could easily be accused of terrorizing Pakistanis because It has drones over Pakistan ready to rain down death at a moment's notice. Now, quite apart from the terror of those who are the victims of murderous attacks, just the knowledge that the drones are there must exert a terrorizing effect on entire populations. Is it a stretch of the imagination to think that research is being carried out, even now, into the effects of terrorizing people with a view to using drones worldwide? 376.
So also going along these lines is the expanded use of the word terrorism in American media, or the threats of terrorism and that. But also this includes domestic terrorism and passing of laws that use terrorism as part of the justification for the law. Now, how many have ever heard of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act? Last year, I mean, this should have been in all the papers. I mean, this is November 27, 2006. Broadens punishments under the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, and they call any animal enterprise is any U.S. business that uses or sells animal products. Now, I think you'll be hard-pressed to think of those that don't, whether it's milk or wool or whatever. I mean, that covers most businesses in the country. And it says any interference with the business, including their loss of their profits, is a terrorist act. And any interference with any person or entity having any connection or relationship or transaction with any animal enterprises. Now, we know that this is theoretically aimed at those that are burning down the slaughterhouses and that sort of thing, but the language is so broad that it could literally make terrorists out of boycotters of a grocery store. And this is called domestic terrorism. So part of understanding this loss of civil liberties that's been occurring, the habeas corpus, the Warner Act, the terrorist acts, all of this, and the increased surveillance of American citizens and that, is really understanding where the leadership class, the people in power today, are coming from and where they're going. The U.S. is now dominated by a neoconservative group of people, with the shared goal of aggressively asserting U.S. military power worldwide. Now, this comes out of the University of Chicago's Committee of Social Thought. Leo Strauss and Paul Wolfowitz, Alan Bloom, Richard Perle were students. This is back in the 60s. They were working on what, you know, neoconservatism. What does that mean, and where are we going with this? And Adbusters, kind of one of my favorite magazines, says that the neoconservatives believe that their belief in democracy is that, however flawed, is best defended by an ignorant public pumped up on nationalism and religion, and only a militantly nationalist state can deter human aggression. In other words, we have to be powerful and strong to deter the aggressors around the world. And such nationalism requires an external threat. And if one can't be found, then you manufacture it.
747.
The support for the Contras in the 80s is, for a majority of member states at the General Assembly, a clear case of state-sponsored terrorism by the U.S., or the role of the CIA in Nicaragua, mining the harbors in 84, for example, is for them clearly an act of state-sponsored terrorism, or the roles of the anti-Castro Cubans in Florida and their role is in acts of terrorism is for them a clear case of the U.S., sponsoring terrorism, or at least harboring terrorists and not doing anything against them. So in that context, an extremely adversarial context, the U.S. during the 80s, during the Reagan years, it's not going to deny all those acts. What it's going to say is that if a state is involved in an act of terrorism in any way, shape, or form, meaning if a state is involved directly or indirectly in an act of terrorism, then it's not an act of terrorism.
The international war against terrorism, a war in which those who monopolize terror are licensed to exempt themselves from its meaning. Lacking the resources of character to compete head-on, the global corporate gang everywhere relies on controlled images instead. And I think this is its peculiar quality. It's a kind of a public relations totalitarianism. in the first instance. The image set loved most by the gang's crowds are performed around the clock. Symbolic male gangs and corporate logos attacking one another day in and day out in competitive spectacles, all constructed to glorify the riches of the winners. The never-ending sudden-death dramas hold the many in thrall, and so the actual violent struggles of life and death in the wider world are diverted from.
376.
According to Herman and Chomsky, the media maintains a corporate class bias through five filter systems: concentrated private ownership, a strict bottom line profit orientation, an over-reliance on government and corporate sources for news, a tendency to avoid offending the powerful, and an almost religious worship of the market economy, and strongly opposing any alternative beliefs. So this was coming out of the Cold War. This was a way of understanding how media was working at that time. And the owners and the managers, they share a class identity with the powerful. And they're motivated economically to please their advertisers, and the viewers, for that matter. And their conception of what is newsworthy is influenced by their social background, their values, and what they call common sense. So journalists and editors are not immune from influence from owners and managers, and journalists want to see their stories in print. And editors come to know the limits, or what we call the parameters, of the common sense view of the world. So a whole lot of what passes for censorship or manufacturing consent is structural, in that journalists and editors come to understand what's acceptable news. And it's just part of the system. It's common sense within the system. So a lot of reasons these stories don't come out is kind of what we call self-censorship. They're just not seen as appropriate, or there's restricted and the filters are preventing that process. We also know that essentially the corporate media in the U.S. is in the entertainment business. Now, you know, we went back and checked when Paris Hilton went to jail. Fox News, in 3 weeks, had 56 headline stories on Paris Hilton. Now, I understand that Lindsay Lohan has just got arrested, so I think that's going to continue to be making the news as we go along. And so there's a, you know, whether it's Anna Nicole Smith dying or having her baby and all of that, there's an entertainment value that has an opportunity cost. So Neil Postman called the American society the best entertained, least informed society in the world. He said that 15 years ago, and that's becoming increasingly more evident today.
Hold the many in thrall, and so the actual violent struggles of life and death in the wider world are diverted from. They are displaced onto the sports or the war screen as a universal marketing site for corporations and banks. Behind the scenes, the real action goes on. Instruments of transnational trade and investment, competitive mergers and privatization and deregulation of the public sector are the deep booty system. Outside of the manufactured conflicts of the mass spectacle games the many have their hearts and minds fastened to, the world is restructured as a pay-on-time system where the payments issue more and more demand for all to pay. As this or that entertainment product wins or loses in the Colosseum, the gang's trade lawyers secretly construct hundreds of new laws behind everyone's backs in which only the rich can win, from outside the market, by the way. The new world order is backed by iron cages, starvation, rains of gas in clubs for resistors, and genocide for peoples from which the latest declared enemy comes. But few dare to name the game. And so its order is ritualized with ever more one-sided shows of mass destruction and violence discharged on the dispossessed to demonstrate the inevitability of its rule. Outside the bombing of poor peoples, whatever stands in the way of the global corporate gang's axings of expenditures on life is declared an obstacle to its freedom, in revealing slogan, a protectionist barrier. Any public law to regulate, protect, or retain control over any sector of domestic economies is prohibited. There is a prize for all this, and it is a prize without end. All free existence which corporate vehicles can reconstruct to extract profit from. without limit. In the end, the global corporate gang wages a war on life organization itself. I think it's really a metaphysical meaning here. The world and the revealing terms of the occupiers is a limitless market opportunity for, quote, maximum penetration and control. Yet in the era of the global knowledge economy, there is a vulnerability of this reign of fear and rapine which cannot be overcome. It can only work where its deep pattern evades exposure. Now I move into the final part, which I call the new totalitarianism. The deep pattern of the male corporate gang in its global form is, as David Rockefeller put it at the June 1991 Bilderberg meeting in Baden, Germany, a, quote, supernational sovereignty of an intellectual elite and world bankers, which is surely preferable to the national autodetermination practiced in past centuries. As such a structure of world rule, it is accomplished by the same financial and media system deciders that put Tony Blair in office in Britain and George Bush into the White House against majority vote. Transnational corporations have marketed and financed these political leaders to ensure that captive states serve them rather than the peoples the governments are elected by, guaranteeing through state plenipotentiaries and transnational trade edicts that governments can no longer govern them in their common interest without infringing the new trade and investment laws in which transnational corporations are alone granted rights, no rights to anything else. All along, the corporate media have, as Rockefeller again advises, and I quote from the same speech, cooperated, because it's to the media, they have cooperated with this plan for the world by, quote, a discretion of public secrecy for which he thanks them. Quote, it would have been impossible for us to develop a plan for the world if we had been subjected to the light of publicity during those years. With financial and media selectors ensuring compliant party government leaders, all the requirements for this plan for the world have been set in place for a totality of control of world societies by a centralized global system which is by law not accountable to any electorate or indeed anyone or any life requirement. I'm really ashamed of our government in its submissive role in all this. The meaning of the post-September 11 bombing of Afghanistan may be best understood in the light of this background. What is important to recognize beneath all the spasms of propaganda of America's new war and the forces of good versus evil, variations on a very old theme, is that every step and preparation and aftermath of this whole new war with no end confers cumulatively more strategic, legal, and military control over the world's peoples and resources from an unaccountable U.S. financial and armed force center. That's its meaning. But the war with no end is not just for world dominion and, as it is humorously titled, a fight for civilization. The grand prize of this war is unimpeded control by multinational oil corporations over the world's greatest oil and gas deposits, which are located around the Caspian Sea of Central Asia, the former territory of the Soviet Union. I just remind you in passing that the war against Saddam Hussein, who many of you may recognize, was given the green light by the U.S. Ambassador April Glaspie a few days before the invasion of Kuwait. The key there that nobody ever talks about is 95% of the oil of Iraq is publicly owned, and the people won't give it up. Longtime U.S. strategic advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski counseled, quote, in 1997, unhindered financial and economic access to precisely these, quote, Central Asia natural resources. This is in the Grand Chessboard, referring specifically to, quote, the enormous economic prize of natural gas and oil located in the region, close quote. Brzezinski advised that in the face of domestic resistance, it will become, quote, ever more difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues. And now I emphasize what he says following that. Except in the circumstances of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat.
It's the only way you'll be able to move in on those old oil fields.
118.
And at three separate points in this book, I culled quotes which I've used now in lectures in three countries. Brzezinski says that without an attack on the order of Pearl Harbor, or unless the American people felt their sense of domestic well-being seriously threatened, or without a direct external threat, they would never support the, this is a quote, the imperial mobilization necessary to control Central Asia. I mean, some of the quotes in there make Dracula look like a somebody I'd want for a marriage and family counselor.
Whatever for dinner, pal.
It was shocking, and we have clearly seen in what Dick Cheney calls this war that will not end in our lifetimes. Our model at From the Wilderness, I think, is being proven as time goes by that this is a sequential war to control the last remaining oil reserves on the planet. And we were talking before the show, and I think it gives these latent Nazis now the opportunity to come out in full dress uniform, because we are seeing now this is such a criminal regime, and they are going forward. The more opposition starts behind them, the faster they move into totalitarian imperialist aggression.
Well, this is the doctrine of total power, and it conceive of no limit to itself. As earth events interfere in resistance to the unaccountable world rule, military and police links are forged on the very sites of any resistance. Constructing and exploiting the new system requires this enemy to justify the sweeping new powers of coercion and terror which the global corporate system requires to rule an increasingly unwilling world. As in all protection rackets by terror and financial manipulation, the greatest threat to life comes from the very system of armed force surveillance and attack which is said to be protecting citizens from it. Conceptualized by presidential proclamation after September 11 as one in which everyone in every region are for us or for the terrorists, with us or for the terrorists. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick, in a less known comment, explained this meaning to include precisely those protesting against the WTO. And notice it was at the height of this that this whole incident occurred. Quote, this president and this administration will fight for open markets. We will not be intimidated by those who have taken to the streets to blame trade and America for the world's ills. That's his response to 9/11. Totality of rule is not the only parameter of totalitarianism. In Hannah Arendt's phrase, limitless of power also proceeds from an omnipresent center. In the new totalitarian movement, this omnipresent directive force communicates through global financial and media control centers with Washington and Wall Street, the dominant nodes of the interlocked system. The world's means of life and mass media are the material and the symbolic vehicles, respectively, by which the flows of goods and demand for goods control the world populations. The regulating principle of all decisions is to multiply by ever more deregulation and new financial instruments the monetized circuits of power through which directive control of all of the world's means of existence increasingly pass. The telltale sign of the totalitarian movement is that it cannot stop by its nature. It careens from one life-destructive crisis and suppression to another in supreme confidence of its limitless power and capacities until its overreach exposes it to collapse or destruction. Armed terror is not the essence, but the punctuation mark of the new totalitarianism's meaning. The money and consumption command channel is the secret of the movement's success because it avoids responsibility for all its failures. Wall Street prescribed market failures to provide for societies are instead always attributed to transcendental forces of the invisible hand, punishing these societies for alleged sins against market laws. It's probably the most dominant superstition in the history of our race. Thus, as catastrophes increasingly befall the majority of the world, the victims are blamed for their new deprivation and misery. This is a far more effective mode of rule than jackboot terror, which is more overt, but it exposes the system to another form of resistance. For such a regime depends throughout on keeping knowledge silenced and repressed. This is its Achilles heel. As soon as people see through it and flag it to the surrounding community, the collective trance which it depends on begins to come undone.
And that is, of course, a very serious flaw in the world of 2019. Do we think that it's going to get easier and easier to control information flows? Or are people going to be more able to send it where they like? There is an argument that says, yes, they're inside all these computer chips because they've nobbled Intel and all the rest, and they're just getting their system up and running, and then they'll turn on the hardcore censorship. Well, I don't know about that. Is it possible that the 5G network being aggressively rolled out could be subverted? As if so, and people could really share their experiences, that could spell the end of the deep state.
It exposes the system to another form of resistance. For such a regime depends throughout on keeping knowledge silenced and repressed. This is its Achilles heel. As soon as people see through it and flag it to the surrounding community, the collective trance which it depends on begins to come undone. I'm just going to give a quick anecdote. The Royal Society of Canada had a really good conference on the World Trade Organization, yes or no, just in Ottawa a few weeks ago. The chief negotiating lawyers, trade lawyers for our government were there, as well as a member of the Secretariat of the OECD. And the most interesting feature of it, as I observed them in action and in debate, they are utterly incapable of appreciating a counter-argument to any of their positions. They just blinker it out. It's not a question as they come up with the lies, although those will come. It's just a question of not being able to engage. You're dealing here with programmed people.
413.
I had the opportunity in the wake of the end of apartheid in South Africa to join a delegation that was working with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission on a set of hearings they held on the professions. They held hearings on leadership professions in society. They had one on journalism, they had one on law, and they had one on the medical profession. And the behavior of the medical profession in South Africa was appalling. It not only supported apartheid politically, but undermined medical ethics to the core. Now, I should tell you that in South Africa, the white medical society thought of itself very much in the Western tradition. They adopted Western codes of ethics. You may remember the first heart transplant was in South Africa. These were not people who came from a different culture or ethical stance, except that there was a regime that was engaged in institutionalized violence against the black majority population. And so what did doctors get involved in? They got involved in falsifying autopsy reports in prisons. They were all involved in refusing to treat black patients. A friend of mine, two friends, wrote a book called An Ambulance of the Wrong Color, and that referred to the fact that if a black person was injured, for example, in a car accident, a white ambulance would not pick up the person and take him or her to the hospital because it was of the wrong color. So they would rather let people die than breach the apartheid segregation laws. And doctors were a part of this. And, of course, the ultimate was the death of anti-apartheid activist Steve Biko, who was, in his day, the leading activist, who was beaten to death in jail. But before he died, he was evaluated by two physicians after he'd been severely brain damaged. And the physicians essentially said there's nothing wrong with him, and they put him on the back of a truck and transported him 400 miles, during which trip he died. And the doctors were asked, why did you do this? Why didn't you reveal the extent of his injuries? And they said, well, we subordinated our medical judgment to the security police interests. We can see in this example, probably even more than in the first case, how easy it was for the medical profession to absorb the values of the larger society. And at the Truth and Reconciliation hearings, the reconstituted Medical Society of South Africa came with a kind of mea culpa and basically said, you know, we really abandoned our values because we were part of the regime, we were part of the culture of apartheid in South Africa. Now, it turns out, actually, when you look around the world, these breaches of what we think of fundamental ethical values are actually quite common.
You're dealing here with programmed people.
And interesting on the street, and then when I went on the street, and I just tell a little anecdote, and here was this three-level riot police with all in their Darth Vader uniforms and so forth, and these kids playing and celebrating in a center about 40 feet from them, everybody terrorized by them. And I found myself moving towards them and standing in front of them and just trying to stare through their visors, to see through to their eyes, see through to the humanity. And then I just shook my head. When I did that, the biggest of the member broke rank, a guy about 6'5", broke his rank out of the middle of them and ran towards me and went like this with his big steel bat on and said, "You're a threat. You're shaking your head." And I really think, in reflection, is not only absurd, this is the symptom of the totalitarian society we're going to, but I think he's right. If you shake your head, you are to this system. The new totalitarianism is ultimately an American confidence game, which rules the world by images and projections of power arcing over the globe's surface, while limitlessly rapacious financial sequences called free flows of capital and commodities strip the world's peoples and their life ground underneath. The evidence is all around. The meta pattern is most globally fatal with the planetary ecosystem, but it is played out catastrophically on the social level in Russia, Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, and Southeast Asia since 1990. But never is the private and centralized financial control of these operations raised publicly as an issue. Nor is the control of the money used by private investment banks and the financial divisions of corporations, whose revenues are generated on the basis of creating over 95% of the world's money demand, is created by private financial institutions.
611.
What you have today is a new kind of a war. It's a financial war. You can get by privatization and financialization what armies used to get by force of arms. This is not the class war that people spoke of 100 years ago. It is a financial war. And it is a war that classical economists warned against. 300 years of classical political economy sought to get rid of landlords and bankers. 100 years ago, people spoke of technology. Nobody believed that the vested interests could fight back. But they did fight back in the way that parasites do in biological nature. I've read in the Italian newspapers coming over on the airplane that people talk about parasites. And people think of parasites as taking the host's energy and the lifeblood. But in biology, the smart parasites do something else. They take over the brain of the host. They make the brain think that the parasite is part of the body to be protected. In America, President Obama and Treasury Secretary Geithner says the economy cannot survive without bailing out the banks, without bailing out the debt, without making the gamblers and the kleptocrats whole on what they have taken. The production economy, the consumption economy, the real economy is being sacrificed to the financial sector. But matters don't have to be this way.
But never is the private and centralized financial control of these operations raised publicly as an issue. Nor is the control of the money used by private investment banks and the financial divisions of corporations, whose revenues are generated on the basis of creating over 95% of the world's money demand, is created by private financial institutions themselves. Thus, the omnipresent center of the interlocked global financial system can deprive hundreds of millions of citizens of their mere means of existence or their life security overnight, through debt issuance and withdrawal of debt issuance, with no exposure of the foreign private powers behind the control of the world money supply constitutionally vested, in fact, in national governments. It's never raised as an issue. It's an unspeakable. So the question arises, where is the failed global experiment of this totalizing rule by private corporate power ever raised?
Where has it ever even spoken, whispered inside our government caucuses? The ground of the silence in even social science classrooms is that this monopolist program has become internalized as a public value set. That's the key. The omnipresent center is in this way made more invisible and unaccountable as it spreads. It's inside. The public signifiers and meanings to it are increasingly ruled out in the steering media to set the public mind lock upon which this totalitarian system depends. All becomes secret in the war with no end to ensure closure against the public even knowing the lines of this world advance. And you notice the newest tactic, which was never available before. We're at war, Bush the other night. We're at war. Anytime any embarrassing question, we're at war. Can't talk about it.
167.
Now, back in 1970, some people wanted me prosecuted for espionage or treason because I had given information about the intelligence agencies to members of Congress, the press, and the courts. If that had happened, however, I would have had the reasonable expectation that I would be prosecuted in a federal civilian court with the usual protections of the Constitution and maybe even some high-priced lawyers. Today, you can't be so sure. The administration claims we are at war, and that anyone suspected of working for or somehow associated with Al-Qaeda is an enemy combatant. Now, as we know from the Padilla and Elmira cases, you don't have to have fought in combat or even been a member of a combat unit in order to be called an enemy combatant. The label is all that suffices. Once the label is attached to you by John Ashcroft, you can be taken away from the jurisdiction of a federal court, locked up in a military brig in South Carolina, denied access to an attorney, denied access to your family, and held indefinitely. Worse, the Bush administration reserves the power, that it asserts, since it's never been really affirmed, to take you out of that brig someday and prosecute you before a special military tribunal. A tribunal that has been rigged to not follow the standard rules of evidence in either military or civilian courts.
All becomes secret in the war with no end to ensure closure against the public even knowing the lines of this world advance. And you notice the newest tactic, which was never available before. We're at war. Bush the other night. We're at war. Anytime any embarrassing question, we're at war. Can't talk about that. To sustain acquiescence in the sacrifices it requires, totalitarian movement must keep its subjects off balance by a non-stop succession of disruptive changes and demands.
398.
Why do we have the most mental illness of all countries studied? Perhaps in spite of the rhetoric, we don't have the right early childhood experiences programmed into how society functions in the United States of America. Could it be that in spite of all the talk, we don't have family values in place? Those are strong deterrents to having good health, both mental and physical. And of course, there are other indicators of how poorly children fare in this country compared to other rich countries. We have the highest proportion of children living in poverty, the highest rates of homelessness among children, the highest rates of death from child abuse. We have twice the teen birth rate of the next closest rich country. We have the highest rates of child injury deaths. So it should be no surprise, too, that we have the highest infant mortality rate, the highest child mortality rate, and the highest youth homicide rate. We medicate our children with psychoactive drugs such as Ritalin, Zyprexia, and Paxil, and we use them more than in other countries.
Private fear for one's security is a necessary condition across communicatively isolated citizens for their submission to such a regime. The violation of long accepted norms presented as fait accomplis and the loss of life bearings by permanent threat to secure livelihood are the psychological operations which are at work in any totalitarian movement. To keep the majority in a continual state of inner anxiety works because people are made too busy securing or competing for their own survival to cooperate in mounting an effective response. In the past decade, the entire population of the globe has been kept permanently off balance with one financial meltdown and transnational trade fiat after another. Notice how they're moving ahead with those rapidly now. after emptying national coffers and overriding rights of the domestic self-determination. Populations have been so overwhelmed by the moving juggernaut of economic and environmental crises that a rule of universal insecurity has rendered social majorities paralyzed by a low-intensity terror, the necessary condition for any totalitarian movement to continue its advance. For keeping its subjects perpetually off balance is its modus operandi. That is why in the Afghanistan case, the war no sooner seems over than the cry goes up, who is next? You have to keep it moving. Arendt's 1955 study, The Origins of Totalitarianism, is confined, quote, to the only two forms of totalitarianism we know, Nazism and Stalinism. But Arendt warns in words that are not remembered that totalitarianism is, quote, a never-present danger grounded in the endless process of capital and power accumulation. Those are Hannah Arendt's words, which erupts past former historical and social limits by, quote, alliance with classless masses. Arendt's far-seeing overview of endless capital accumulation mobilizing as an overwhelming social force by alliance with classless masses is revealingly silent in even scholarly texts on Arendt's work. This is all part of the silent collaboration and in complacent analyses of totalitarianism as only elsewhere. The agenda of thought is rather distant rogue states or shadowy foreign terrorists, which are ever ready as new pretexts for more mechanisms of social repression. The negative solidarity of atomized masses, that's Arendt's term,